The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me for tonight's show. We're going to begin this evening with a pioneering media executive who created some truly legendary programs for MTV. He is Nusrat Durrani, who believes that a better world will require radical change, which is never easy.
But it also, it will require risk-taking. It will require us to be able to withstand pain. Because with radical change comes a lot of pain. I don't think that you'll ever see change occur without pain occurring.
And then I'll be joined by Scott Harrison, the founder and CEO of Charity Water and the author of a great new book titled Thirst, a story of redemption, compassion, and a mission to bring clean water to the world. Scott tells us what he was trying to achieve with this book.
I wanted to show people that, you know, no matter how stuck you might feel, no matter how you might have messed up in the past, chances are you weren't half as bad as I was. I mean, it would be, unless you killed someone, as you read this, it's going to be hard to imagine a worse person that you might know. And I really wanted to show that nobody is beyond redemption.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, December 16th. The Just Capital Foundation, in partnership with Forbes, has released the 2018 ranking of the 100 most socially just companies in the United States. Microsoft ranked first overall, followed by Intel and Alphabet, the parent company of Google. Lyft is partnering with Martha's Table, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit, to give rides to local families living in food deserts. For $2.50, qualifying families can ride to and from a number of grocery stores in the region, including Safeway and Giant. Billionaire investor Ron Perlman and his daughter Deborah gave Princeton University $65 million to build a new Perlman College, the university's seventh residential college. Social norms, behaviors that are common, valued, and accepted by others, influence charitable giving to women's and girls' causes, according to a report from the Women's Philanthropy Institute. So when people believed others were interested in giving to women's and girls' causes, they were more likely to say they would donate to those causes too. The most generous country in the world is Indonesia, followed in order by Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and Ireland, according to a new Gallup study. The report found that 78% of Indonesians had donated money to charity. In comparison, 61% of Americans had done so.
And finally, in recent years, a number of philanthropists have been directing their giving to examining artificial intelligence. And here from the Chronicle of Philanthropy to tell us how much and where it's going is Maria Demento. Good evening, Maria.
Hi, Denver. How are you?
Doing great. So how much money is going towards this issue and who have been some of the major donors of it?
Right now, or actually it's just in the last few years since 2015, we've seen a total of about $584 million going to programs that deal with artificial intelligence. And, you know, that's not very much time for such a large gift. So there have been some really large ones, even just most recently last month. The New York financier Stephen Schwarzman gave $350 million to MIT to establish a college of computing that is aimed at expanding programs in artificial intelligence and other related sciences. Paul Allen, the late Microsoft co-founder, this year also gave, earlier this year, he gave $125 million to the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, specifically to support a research program that is trying to instill common sense in artificial intelligence. So we're seeing really big gifts. Those are two of the largest, but there have also been, you know, $20 million, $10 million, things like that. There's been quite a bit going toward this cause. Just like I said, just in the last 20 months or so.
Yeah. Are there any specific issues that they're looking to examine?
There are. There seems to be a split between wanting to put money into developing new AI programs and tools, and then people who want to give money to programs that are researching what AI is doing to us as a society, what it's doing to human life, and for programs that are trying to use AI for good and sort of scale back or rein in some of its more negative features or more negative aspects that it can have on human life.
Yeah,
so you're really seeing people who want to make the most of it and people who want to rein it in.
Yeah, there's a lot of concern, it seems like, around these ethical issues. And it's interesting that a lot of the same people who spawned artificial intelligence are the ones who seem to be the most concerned or perhaps feel responsibility to addressing that particular facet of it.
I think that's definitely the case. When we did our analysis, we found 9 wealthy donors had given that total of 584 to nonprofit institutions developing new artificial intelligence tools and studying the effects of AI on human life. And indeed, a lot of them were tech people. I had mentioned Paul Allen, but we also saw people who are less well-known, a young guy named Austin McCord, who founded a cybersecurity company called Datto. He gave $20 million as part of a larger gift to Rochester Institute of Technology to hire cybersecurity and artificial intelligence faculty at the school. And so, I think you're seeing even people like Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn. He has given $10 million to the Ethics and Governance of Artificial Intelligence Fund, which is a collaboration between MIT's Media Lab and Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. And that gift was to develop ethical artificial intelligence to serve humanity. So, you know, you're really seeing some real concern among these people about what's happening with AI and how rapidly it's expanding and really touching our lives.
Yeah, well, this is a wonderful role for philanthropy because I know, having had some people on the show, there isn't the level of concern sometimes in Silicon Valley. They're more looking at what it can do and not so much on the ethical concerns. Well, thank you very much, Maria, for this report. It was great to have you on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans' families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
I have the great pleasure to bring you changemakers each week who strive to create social good around issues such as poverty, gender equity, hunger, education, and disease. And tonight, you'll meet someone who looks at these issues from a slightly different and very interesting perspective. He is Nusrat Durrani, a pioneering media executive, creator of some of MTV's most iconic programs, and champion of radical change for social impact. Good evening, Nusrat, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much, Denver. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start with MTV, because it is so central to what has become your life's work, and because your journey there was so unusual and interesting. How did it come to pass?
Well, I've been a fan of music all my life, in fact, and I grew up listening to rock and roll in India. But actually, we never had MTV in India when I was growing up, and I encountered MTV in, of all places, Dubai in the Middle East in the 90s when they had just launched a feed for that region. And the moment I watched the channel on television, I was hypnotized, and that's where my fascination for the brand began.
Mm-hmm. So much so that you actually came to New York looking for work.
Exactly. And, I had this this fantasy that I would walk into the MTV office and they would instantly hire me and then the rest would be history, you know. But of course, I was rejected and heartbroken. And, they were very politely declined my offer to work mm-hmm. for them. And I had to go back.
In which they declined it again.
And yes, indeed. And so I kept at it. Indeed, I actually I got on a flight from Dubai and came to New York and decided that I won't actually give up until I was hired. I had no plan B.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they did hire me.
Yeah, as an intern, correct?
As an intern. It was one of the hardest decisions I've ever made in my life to be at that point in my career, which was, I was 35 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I'd had a full-fledged, really interesting career up to that point in the automobile business. And then there I am starting as an intern for MTV. It was just bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did a good job there. They eventually hired you. And I think if there was a pivotal moment in your career, it was when you were at a meeting in 1997 and you spoke up. Tell us about that and what occurred.
Well, for me, MTV was a culture shock, as was New York City, to mm-hmm. be honest. And I had a fairly sophisticated idea of the U.S., of New York, and of MTV because I'd read everything about it before I even stepped foot inside their offices. What disappointed me about the company was that they were, incredibly American-centric in their programming. Even though we were an international brand, it was really American culture being pumped into all these other countries. And on MTV in the U.S., there wasn't a whole lot of the world of, the world of global pop music mm-hmm. on the channel. And that was always disappointing. It was also disappointing to know that somebody like me, who came from the outside, wasn't expected to know anything about American pop music. That, to me, was the revelation. And I didn't say a word, also because my personality was very reticent and very sort of reserved.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously media in New York City is dominated by type A really aggressive personality.
Yeah.
And there I was, this guy who had been trained in a very Japanese environment, just politely listening to the discourse and never saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
And until there came a point, and this point that you were talking about, that we were in a meeting brainstorming, movies that rock. And the subject of Bob Dylan films came up. And
one of your twin gods, along with David Bowie.
Dylan is an icon to me and still yes. is. And I thought I knew everything about him. And when it came to questions about Dylan movies, I couldn't resist. I just had to speak up and propose a film. And as soon as I did that, there was just pin drop silence in the room. Like there was a chill that came over the room. And I couldn't understand what I said wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, I realized later on, was that it wasn't that I said anything wrong. It was that I said anything at all. I wasn't supposed to know anything about Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a pivotal moment in my career, but also in my journey as a U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm.
We're not supposed to, if you're from India, you're not supposed to know anything about American pop music, and nothing could be more ridiculous.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And, let's get back a little bit to that and also what you said about coming to MTV. This limited knowledge that Americans have of the rest of the world, I know that you were both surprised by it. And also probably a little disappointed in it. And to the extent that it does exist, it's very one-dimensional. It's what we see on CNN or MSNBC, and we paint these countries with one brush. What do you think about the impact of that on a society?
I think it's tragic on many levels. I think it's tragic because there is a lot to be learned from the rest of the world, obviously. We have exported our ideas, our technologies, our philosophies, our pop culture to the rest of the world. And we had that the opportunity to bring some of that back from the countries that we were engaging with. And we've done a pretty bad job of that. And I view that as a very imperialistic approach to engaging with the world. It's no different from when we were invading these countries and plundering them. And I think that we've been doing that with our pop culture, never really creating a two-way conversation and bringing culture back, bringing ideas back into this country. So we are really the losers in that. If we had done a better job of that, I think we may have found the world to be a less turbulent place because we had a better understanding of it.
Yeah.
We would understand China differently. We would understand India, the Middle East very differently. We would understand Latin America very differently. We have no idea about really what happens in these countries.
No.
And to some extent, actually, it's beneficial in a very evil way to not give Americans a more sophisticated understanding of these countries.
Explain that.
For instance, I mean, Yemen is a tragic place these days, right?
Yeah.
Partly because we are engaged. You know, we're engaged. We are responsible for a lot of the violence, a lot of innocent people dying there. If America was actually, if the average American was actually given to understand what is happening there and why it's happening, and on a human level, you know, you got to know the young Yemeni children that are dying of hunger, starvation, and disease. You got to know the teenagers that are frustrated. You got to know parents who are losing their children. I think we would be less supportive about what is happening there. Same thing with Afghanistan. Same thing with any of these countries that in the abstract, it's okay for us to bomb and to do whatever we want to them because we don't see them as human.
We don't even see them.
We don't see them.
We don't see them at all.
It seems like,
and you know, some of this calculus is crazy. You know, you take Khashoggi.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, the focus that we had on Khashoggi compared to, let's say, the bus of boys that was blown up in Yemen is completely out of proportion.
Absolutely.
And then what we're thinking about doing because of what happened to Khashoggi is stop supporting the bombing of Yemen. And I'm like, who can follow this logic?
I know. Absolutely. It's mind-boggling. But actually, the Khashoggi example is a really good one. The reason I think that that story has so much traction is because it's a story about an individual that we know something about. You know, we can relate to that story. This is a man who used to work in D.C. He's a journalist. He's trying to get married to somebody. He's going to the Saudi embassy to get his papers, all that. It's a human story.
Right.
And when human beings start getting involved in stories, that's when it becomes harder to be ignorant about the tragedies that we bestow upon them. And a lot of my work at MTV has actually been about demystifying and making human many of the countries that are in turbulence.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if a million people are starving from famine, we don't really relate to that the way we can relate to one person who is doing that. And that's just the way our brain works. Well, these are the other voices that you're talking about, and you've really been a champion of those other voices from other countries, particularly the youth who are fighting oppression and injustice, but also have joys and dreams of their own. And an enterprise that you were a big advocate for and launched at MTV with a little bit of sweat equity to get it done from the executives there was something called Rebel Music. Tell us about Rebel Music.
Well, Rebel Music was, to me, was born out of my observation and also my research with U.S. audiences. And obviously, being engaged in media, my observation about mainstream media in the U.S. And what an appalling and pathetic job we do of explaining the world to Americans. So if you ask the average person, what do you think of Afghanistan? What is Afghanistan?
Taliban.
You know, the Taliban, exactly. It's the Taliban, it's misogyny, it's violence. Our troops are there. Are they with us or not with us? You know, that kind of stuff. Meanwhile, Afghanistan, like any other country, is no different from ours in some regards, right? I mean, it has a relatively young population. These young people have dreams and ambitions, and they like music, and they like food, and they ride motorcycles, and they have very bad death metal bands and stuff like that. There are human beings living in Afghanistan. And you take any country that is turbulent and in the news, whether it's Egypt or Iran or, Turkey or, Yemen or Argentina, same thing.
One sound bite and that's it.
That's right. So we have actually reduced entire countries, entire cultures to one stereotypical explanation. Iran is a crazy point, axis of evil.
Yep.
I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. Mm-hmm. Iran is not the axis
of
evil.
One of the oldest civilizations on the planet.
On the planet. And amazing culture. And, maybe we don't like their politics, but that's a handful of people.
Mm-hmm.
It does not constitute the entire civilization. And so point of rebel music was present young musicians and activists in those countries and really showcase oppression and injustice that they themselves are fighting and really recast those countries in a completely new light.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was told by a lot of folks within MTV and elsewhere that this is it's a complete disaster.
Yeah.
This is never going to work. Nobody cares. Young people in the U.S. don't care about what's happening in Afghanistan or Iran. And I found that nothing could be further from the truth than that.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about how we present those stories and what we say about these countries. And case in point is Rebel Music Native America, which is...
about our country.
It's about our country.
Right?
It's not even about... So until we did that, and by the way, it was very hard for me to produce that authentically because the Native American people are so sick and tired of being stereotyped and dismissed in this country.
Well, they had to be suspicious of you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They were very reluctant to work with us because they thought, here comes MTV.
Here we go again.
They're just going to, do as poor a job as everyone else in telling our stories. And it was only after I was able to convince them that, no, you will be telling your own stories. We're here to create to bring our platform to you,
mm-hmm.
that they agreed. And then, of course, we got amazing stories.
Yeah.
And
amazing response as well. I mean, you just broke the charts on that one. And maybe I see a little bit about collaboration, because that was a tough collaboration. That took you about a year and a half.
Yes, it took a long time to produce.
Any secrets to collaboration? I mean, how did you bring that together?
Well, we tried many, many things. I mean, we created an advisory council of only Native people, their elders, their young people, and, lots of people from across the community. And we said, look, I actually had to beg them. I'm like, I beg you to help me with this because I'm trying to do the right thing. I am trying to have America take a look at what young Native people are. And it's only after I assured them that I would not mess with the stories that they said, okay, we'll open up the community. And once they did that, we were exposed to incredible artists.
Yeah.
And we let the artists basically tell their stories. And their stories are amazing.
Yeah, they
are. I mean, it's like as Frank Wall, who's a hip-hop act from South Dakota, says, I mean, he's like, you shouldn't be waiting for the world to come and tell our stories. We're gonna do that ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they're changing their narrative.
Yeah.
It's very empowering.
Mm-hmm. Well, building trust takes some time. You can't rush it, and that's exactly what you did. You know, another side of this, another side of giving voice to the voiceless, is to broaden our understanding and appreciation of areas that go beyond the way they are depicted in the media. As you have said, for example, fashion is essentially thin white girl. That's it. And that would also be true with the portrayal of love. Speak to that and your work in that area.
I mean, as you said, I think in any area of but any segment of pop culture or in the world of relationships, I think that there's a continuum of realities.
Hmm.
Right? There isn't only the one thing. I mean, the thin white girl thing that you're talking about, it's a Western construct. In fact, where I grew up, voluptuous women were the standard of beauty because our goddess system is based upon, the female body is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's only a Western construct. If you take Africa, what Africans think is beautiful, whether it be men or women, very different.
Sure.
I think in general, the idea here is that we have allowed the Western ideals, and by the way, these ideals are often architected or constructed by a handful of people.
Yep.
I mean, Condé Nast decides, or whichever group, what is considered beautiful.
The standard.
And I think that that is completely and totally unfair, because there are many, many ways to view beauty. And I think that in the same way that, you know, as you were talking about love, there is more than one love story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what I've tried to do in some of my work is to really expand and to widen our aperture of love itself and not regurgitate the same story again and again. So, you know, I made a film called Madly,
mm-hmm.
Which is an anthology of short films about sort of relatively, you know, unusual love stories, if you will, from different parts of the world. It's almost like a state of union of love at that point. And so we had a story about an older woman in love with a younger man. We had a story about a love gone wrong between an older man and a younger woman. We had a story about a woman's very sort of almost like really apprehensive and tender and uncertain love for a newborn baby. Things like that. And it turned out to be quite interesting. The film won a Best Actress Award at Tribeca.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really was a mosaic of love stories from around the world. It's not a project that you would see every day.
Yeah, you do some daring stuff. Well, after 20 or so years, you left MTV once you had described it as the best job in the world. But you continue on your mission to give voice to the voiceless. And to that end, you flew to Lebanon and a Syrian refugee camp to hear from a group of people we never hear from in relation to this crisis, the Syrian refugees themselves. What did you hear? What did you witness, which was at odds with the prevalent narrative?
Basically everything. Yes. I mean, so the narrative here, and this isn't a narrative I necessarily believed. Certainly, I was reading it and hearing it every single day before I went to meet the refugee community itself. The narrative is, even today, is that some of these people are terrorists. They are really out to just sort of immigrate to the U.S. They want to take our jobs, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. It's just this really negative poetry around what are some of the most unfortunate people in the world who really had nothing to do with the crisis that they're living in.
Yeah.
I mean, the Syrian refugees are not responsible for what's happening in their country.
No.
In fact, everything they ever had has been taken away, and they're suffering, and they've had to take these perilous journeys to actually be refugees. So everything that I had ever heard about them is wrong. They're bitter, angry, hostile, desperate,
mm-hmm.
Desperate to come to the U.S. or to other Western countries, desperate to take our jobs. All of this.
Wrong.
Absolutely untrue. I actually, in may have met 200 or 300 refugees, met meaning spoken to,
mm-hmm.
Apart from seeing thousands of them. I didn't meet a single refugee that said to me, can you please organize a way for me to go to the U.S.?
Yeah.
I think if you poll the refugee community, 90% or whatever, a very high number would say, please simply take us back home,
mm-hmm.
As most of us would.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think the narrative around refugees is really an unfortunate one, I think.
Yeah, and a lot of them, I think, you also found to be happy and joyous and resilient. They were just not these broken people that we sometimes believe from what we read.
I mean, I would argue that, you know, I think, well, many refugees that I met were some of the most gracious, brave, you know, hardy people that I have ever met. If I had gone through the trauma that most of them had been through, I would not have dealt with it with so much strength and grace.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. No, I think that's very true. I have a friend in disaster relief, and he went down to Haiti, and he says, my goodness, if what happened in Haiti happened in this country, be night and day, these people just roll with it.
Mm.
And they just get themselves up in the morning and just continue on, where sometimes we don't quite have that. We're a little softer here based on it. How did your time there change you?
Well, I have to say that I feel a little guilty about this, actually, because I think that I learned more and gained more from being in a Syrian refugee camp and working with that NGO that had hosted me, mm-hmm. graciously hosted me, I think I from them much, much more than I give.
That is so often the case. You hear that from everyone. It's amazing, isn't it?
It is the case. And I think that makes me feel a little bit guilty, to be honest, because it transformed me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really probably one of the most important experiences of my life.
Yeah.
And if anything, you know, if there is a way that I can equalize that, that give and take, it is to rededicate myself doing exactly the work that I'm doing, which is to be a representative, almost a voice for people you don't hear from, and to represent their side in places where no one is representing them.
Up at the PopTech conference in Maine that we were both at recently, I was very moved by a short video you showed entitled Stories I Told My Mother. Your mom is a hero to you. Tell us about her, this film, and some of the exceptional women you have encountered in your travels across the globe.
Well, my mother, you're right. I mean, my mother is my hero, and often we associate heroic people with people who've, you know, climbed Mount Everest or done some extraordinary things. And my mother actually has done a lot of extraordinary things. In her life, she has broken the rules. She was not supposed to become the woman that she became.
Mm-hmm.
If not for her being so daring and so courageous, I wouldn't be here with you. I would still be in India, in Lucknow, doing what most kids in Lucknow would do. You know? Not a bad life necessarily, but not a life of adventure, not a life of, you know, making a difference.
Right.
And so she has challenged the status quo numerous times. She's been a man and a woman also in our family. And she has been probably the most selfless person that I know. She never did anything for herself. Her entire life was her family and the poor.
Mm-hmm.
She learned to become a doctor in her 50s. She started the first nursing home in my city.
Mm-hmm.
Very focused on giving subsidized care to the poor, particularly to poor women who were not in a position to have abortions or to deliver their kids or whatever. And she was a pioneer in all of this. And now, you know, she has Alzheimer's. And so she now is unfortunately in the situation that she most dreaded, which was to be entirely at the mercy of others.
Yeah.
And I think to me that's a very poignant and very heartbreaking fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is really, for me, there is nothing more holy than to do whatever I can for my mom, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that. My elder sister really takes care of her. She is really the one bearing the brunt or the sort of the biggest responsibility of being her caretaker. But I do go and spend time with her and I talk to her and I tell her stories, which I'm not sure she is comprehending or understanding or imagining. But, you know, I am traveling a lot and I am trying to bring to her stories that I encounter of women like her, like herself, who are incredibly courageous and brave. And so that short film that you referenced, Denver, is a film that I made because the CEO of PopTech, Letha, who's a friend of mine, said, hey, I want you to do something which is very authentic and from your recent experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I really put that film together very, you know, in a just a very raw state of mind. And it really is a compilation of some of the more interesting stories about brave women who I've either met or heard of in my recent travels. And it takes us from the Syrian refugee girls that I met, who are joyous, beautiful creatures. I mean, really the most uplifting girls I have actually ever met. They've transformed me.
Yeah. And
some of them have seen incredible, incredible hardship. I mean, they've seen their parents get blown up.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they smile, they dance, they laugh. I mean, they're incredible. So it goes from there to a lady called Sue Austin I met in England, who is a wheelchair-bound artist. She has done this underwater ballet that you've got to see to believe. It's marvelous.
I saw it and I didn't believe it.
it's very incredibly hard. And I met her and Sue was just, she transformed me.
Yeah, sure.
From what she does. I mean, she does this incredible art. And I mean, if she can do what she does, You know, I should be able to walk the moon. I mean, literally. Mm-hmm. So empowering. It goes from there to, you know, there are really a lot of examples and some.
Each of them all very, so inspiring.
Incredibly inspiring. I mean, there's the story of Nadia Murad, who mm-hmm. won this year's Nobel Peace Prize. And she is a survivor of the, you know, she survived being a sex slave for ISIL in northern Iraq. Mm-hmm. And she lived to tell her story. I mean, and her story is one of incredible grit and determination and courage. And then it brings it to, you know, our own country where you have these women prisoners in fighting fires in California for like under $2 an hour, risking yeah. their lives. Mm-hmm. So amongst us are all these incredible women doing absolutely unbelievable things. And these are heroic and inspiring stories. And I think that we must focus more on this kind of storytelling.
I fully agree.
Because it's so uplifting. Mm-hmm. And our national discourse is so depressing sometimes.
Right.
And yet amongst us, we've got all these powerful people.
Right.
So the film's really about that. And it's told in a very stream of consciousness manner because I always try to imagine how, if at all, my mom is receiving this information and processing it, how she must, you know, imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's a little abstract. It's a little stream of consciousness.
I liked it.
Thank you so much.
You know, I mean, I like the rawness of it. Let me ask you this. What advice would you have for those people leading the communication effort of nonprofit organizations to make their work and cause more relevant and more engaging?
You know, I've thought about this many times, mm-hmm. actually. I think one of the things, look, first of all, to be a nonprofit is in itself an act of courage. It's very competitive. It's incredibly difficult. So to be burdening them with the storytelling piece of it is also, I mean, hey, you know, I mean, Nusrat, thanks for the advice, but I mean, it's hard enough to do our fundraising and to do the work we do. But, you know, if there is any advice, I would say that I think they need to open a different folder in the brains of the people, that audience that they're trying to communicate with.
What folder would that be?
See, because the thing is, most of the NGOs and profit, I mean, these people doing good work are actually trying to open the folder of compassion,
mm-hmm.
the folder of empathy, the folder of, you know, mercy.
Yeah.
And there happens to be, sadly, an empathy fatigue. You know, I think that we are besieged with so much fundraising, so many pleas for money, for time, for whatever, that we tend to tune out messages that are going into that folder.
We're a little numbed.
We're numb. There's mm-hmm. no question. I mean, we have only that much capacity
yeah.
to give. And although having said that, I will say the American people, I think, are very, very generous.
I would agree.
In general.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people are really good. They want to do good. But our approach has to be different. I mean, there is a formula that you will see in these fundraising videos and these messages that it's quite trite.
Yeah.
I think that we need to be really doing a lot more storytelling around individuals and not for just, you know, hey, this person has been through so much bad stuff that you should take pity on them and give some money to us. Rather than that, I think we should tell the human story of this person, really, and show them in the best possible light that, look, despite what has happened to this person or these people, look what they've done.
Yeah.
Be inspired. I think that these are not just stories of tragedy. These are stories of empowerment and inspiration. In the same way that a lot of the stories I actually talked about in,
sure.
in stories I told my mother are really, you know, I'm not asking anyone to write a check, any of those stories. But more people have actually called me and emailed me and said, how do I actually help the Yazidi community?
Mm-hmm.
Because of what I saw. And you didn't see a single message about, hey, help this or that, you know. I'm just really telling a human story there. So my point in short is that I think we need to approach fundraising and NGO and nonprofit work in the same way that we approach a series for Netflix mm-hmm. or for HBO.
Yeah.
Powerful storytelling, elevated storytelling, good scripts, good cinematography. And let's do away with the formulas.
Yeah, and to your point, and not to be crass, people like to fund winners.
Oh, yeah.
So show some winners sure. of people who've come out the other end, and that is what your money will do.
That's
not somebody who's downtrodden and we have to help this person. Let me back a winner.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. We cannot relate to that, you know, that one-dimensional, trite story.
Many people, yourself included, I would imagine, believe that pop culture can indeed change the world. But how do you think pop culture has to change to make it more profound and meaningful for the people on the planet?
Oh, God, yeah. I think pop culture is this, it's a... It's very conflicting right now because on the one hand, you have the numerous platforms now for pop culture. There's never actually been a better time for pop culture because social media, because, you know, an artist can now really get their stuff out bypassing the traditional methodologies, all of that stuff. But unfortunately, the tastemakers, the big players have not, I think, you know, expanded their toolkit, mm-hmm. if you will. They have not diversified, the playbook. And in the U.S., you'll still see, for instance, the same kind of music being regurgitated time and time and time again. Appalling. I think that the lack of risk-taking.
Yeah.
You simply haven't widened the aperture, and I think that's terrifying, to me at least. In fact, we are inspired by cultures and we borrow from cultures without even giving credit to them. We're big on African culture, for example. You know, we borrow from Africa without ever bringing the artist on stage with us, without even sometimes crediting the artists whose music we're stealing or are being inspired for by.
Long tradition of that.
Oh yeah, and I think I think it's unfair.
Yeah.
But going back to your point, I think that pop culture is profoundly important. But I think pop culture needs to be more collaborative. It needs to be open. It needs to be wide. And I think it's most importantly, we need to stop thinking of as American pop culture being the pop culture of the world. If there was one insight I've gained in more than 20 years at MTV, it's that.
Yeah, yeah.
That pop culture of the world is not American pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than that.
Absolutely.
Each country has its own pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we should no longer, by default, think that our music, our artists, our genres of music or whatever should be the default for the rest of the world.
We might even enjoy a little variety. Who knows?
Absolutely.
You keep on moving. What are you currently working on now?
Well, I'm working on several things, but one of the things I'm working on is really bringing the focus for me back to the U.S., and which is, you know, I think we're in a time and place in the U.S. where a good hard look at ourselves in the mirror might not be a bad idea. And
couldn't agree more.
And without revealing more detail, one of the projects I'm working on is really to articulate and tell stories of Americans that you really never hear from. Our national discourse, our storytelling is very often focused on New York, L.A., Seattle, Chicago, San Francisco, and the big cities, you know. Meanwhile, the rest of the country is where most Americans live. And not only is the rest of the country very beautiful and very diverse, it's also full of amazing stories. Stories that are inspiring, heartbreaking, moving, tragic, uplifting, all of that. And I think that it's time to really reflect and mine and tell those stories. So most of my projects right now are focused on that.
Oh, that's really great. And I had Gene Case of the Case Foundation in the other day. And just to draw a little parallel to what you're saying, in the venture capital world, 78% of venture capital goes to New York, Boston, and California, which means we have 47 states fighting over the other 22%. Doesn't really make a lot of sense. And it's also reflected, as you say, in the way we communicate culture and stories.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that when we talk about inequity,
mm-hmm.
We usually talk about inequity in terms of, you know, distribution of wealth, income, access to health care, education, things like that. I think there is another inequity that exists in the world and in the U.S., and that is the inequity of voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of the 47 states you're talking about simply don't have the voice in the national discourse that they should.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's terrible. It's terrible.
Let me close with this, Nusret. You have said, and I think others have observed it as well, is that the pace of change in the world is happening so fast that we need radical and not incremental change. Do you see that happening? And what do you think it's going to take?
You know, I think it takes people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people make changes, not technologies, not you know, platforms, not algorithms. It's intent. And intent is usually, you know, housed in a person or, you know, set of people. And I think that we need to change our mindset and we have to start thinking radically. I actually completely agree with you. But it will require risk-taking. It will require us to be able to withstand pain because with radical change comes a lot of pain. I don't think that you'll ever see change occur without pain occurring. And that pain is not necessarily physical pain.
Yeah, sure.
It's also just discomfort. It's a change in the way we do things, you know. And I think most people are very uncomfortable with that kind of change. So I think it has to be housed in individuals that have big, epic ideas that are viewing the world in a very divergent manner from most other people, and then executing on those things. Execution is it's a very important thing. I mean, you could have as many thoughts as possible that are amazing and gorgeous, but if you don't execute on them, nothing comes to happen, right? Nothing happens. So I think it's about having radical thinking that is married to beautiful execution, and I think that's how change happens.
Absolutely. Well, Nusrat Durrani, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Where can listeners learn more about your work, or maybe even view some of it for themselves?
Well, most of my MTV work is actually available on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
But also it's available on NusratDurrani.com, which mm-hmm. is my website. And, I would be very happy if you checked it out and actually gave me feedback on it.
Well, we'll certainly do that. Well, Nusrat, I want to tell you, it was just a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Denver. My pleasure.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
It was a bit over a year ago that I had the pleasure to have Scott Harrison, the founder and CEO of Charity Water, on the show. Well, he has recently come out with a great new book titled Thirst, a story of redemption, compassion, and a mission to bring clean water to the world. And I thought it would be a good idea to have him back for a few to discuss it with us. Good evening, Scott, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Hey, Denver, it's great to be back on. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. For any listeners who may not be familiar with Charity Water, just tell us a little bit about the organization.
Yeah, sure. So we are focused on bringing clean and safe drinking water to every single person on this planet. And we are currently about 663 million people, or one-tenth of the world, away from achieving that goal. And we've been fighting for this for about 12 years. And what makes us unique is that 100% of all donations received from the public go directly to funding clean water projects, which we then prove using sensors and using satellite image on Google Earth and Google Maps so people can see where their money's going.
Right.
And that's allowed us to get about 8.5 million people clean water.
Fantastic. You're not our father's charity or our grandfather's charity. Your story, Scott, from a self-absorbed, wasted nightclub promoter to building a purpose-driven life and an extraordinary organization is really beautifully told in Thirst. But after a transformation like that, how have you continued to evolve and grow, and in what ways has that happened?
Yeah, well, right, I write about this in the book. I mean, I was a scoundrel. I was a degenerate nightclub hedonist for about 10 years, and I was fortunate at 28 to change course and go live in a humanitarian organization in West Africa and come across the water crisis. And I think what was important for me was giving up all those vices in one fell swoop.
Mm.
And I just realized that I couldn't smoke again. I could never touch drugs or gamble or, you know, pornography or any of that stuff. I had to really shed the trappings of my old life, you know, in a cold turkey fashion, I guess.
Right.
If I wanted any new story to unfold. And you know, that was now 15 years ago, and my life looks so different now. I've been able to travel the world preaching a message of generosity and compassion and care for others and, you know, preaching a message of clean drinking water. I mean, everybody can agree on that. It's been a really nice thing. And, you know, I'm married. I've got young kids now. And my four-year-old the other day asked me how old he would have to be until he could go and help people get clean water like Daddy. And, you know, that made me feel great for a moment. I didn't really know the answer. I said, I don't know, 16, 18. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but it's got to make you feel very proud.
It's a very different life.
Yeah, it brings a tear to your eye.
Yeah.
Almost, you know? Yeah.
It does, and I would hope that I can make it look fun to my kids. You know, I've been to 69 different countries now. Mm-hmm. I've been to Ethiopia 30 separate times, which is where we have a lot of our work. And you know, I was chasing all the wrong things for so many years, and hope that I can show my kids that a life of serving others and using your talents and your resources to do that is a much more fulfilling life.
For sure. The book is over 300 pages, although I'll tell you, it reads quite a bit faster than that. But that does require a significant amount of recollection and reflection. Was there a part of this book that you most enjoyed writing or was the most beneficial for you as you put down the words onto a piece of paper?
Well, I love the Mercy Ships period of mm-hmm. it. I mean, going back and being able to honor some of the people that really inspired me back then. There was in particular a doctor named Dr. Gary Parker, and his story was amazing. He was a plastic surgeon from California that had heard about this floating hospital and said, "Okay, good, I'll go do 3 months." And when I set foot on that hospital ship, he'd been there 20 years. He's now been there over 35 years. And it was just so fun being able to go back, look through some of the 50,000 photographs that I'd taken
over
that two-year period.
Uh-huh.
And, well, you know, this was the eve of digital.
Yeah.
you shot more than you needed to because it was free.
Yeah.
And it was just fun being able to tell some of those stories and how I eventually found my way to water through health, realizing that so many of these people were sick because they didn't have their most basic need met for health, for life. I mean, imagine not having clean water. Imagine having to walk 6 or 7 hours every day to a swamp. Imagine losing a child in your arms to diarrhea, completely preventable
yeah.
if you just had clean water.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun. I'd say the hardest part to write about was the nightclub part because I was just such an idiot. And, you know, there's some people, as we interviewed them, you know, that I realized it really hurts living a valueless life or certainly a life with you know, with all the wrong intentions.
Yeah, that's so...
It was tough facing some of those demons.
Yeah. Interesting when you look back like that. Well, speaking of stories, you are the consummate storyteller, and maybe that's one of the skills you did pick up as a nightclub promoter that turned out to actually be pretty useful. What do you believe are the keys to telling a great story, and how has that helped advance the work of Charity Water?
Well, gosh, I just think storytelling is... It's the most critical piece to the organization's success. I think it's why we've been able to raise over $250 million in a short time and get a million people excited about an issue that really doesn't face them. I mean, I think, look, most people listening right now did not wake up this morning saying, "Oh, I need to do something about the global water crisis."
Right.
And most people didn't wake up with the 660 million people on their mind. They woke up and probably took a long shower and used some water, maybe from their Brita filter, you know, to make their coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only stories that can get people to pause and say, well, what if I woke up this morning, like a woman named Eberhat we were just with in Ethiopia, and I walked 2.5 hours, and I walked down to a swamp, and I was worried about hyena attacks on that walk. I was worried about maybe even being raped. And then I waited and I dug in the sand and I found water and then I hauled it back 3 miles, 40 pounds on my back to then give it to my children. And I walked in and my children were crying and I knew that this water might kill them, but there was no other solution. You know, I think it's telling these stories. There's a story in the book where I lived in a village where a 13-year-old girl hung herself.
Yeah.
She spilled her water
mm-hmm.
after one of these walks. And, you know, I think everybody listening would agree that a 13-year-old girl shouldn't have a noose hanging around her neck because she spilled her water. But when you understand it in the context of her life and her struggle and her village, it actually makes a lot of sense. And I think it's the stories that are able to maybe get people to reject the apathy that's
yeah.
so easy to embrace with these global issues and say, wow, maybe I could do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could help one person, one family, one community.
Yeah, and I think you have a wonderful way of putting the reader or the listener in the scene of the story that you're telling. You almost feel like you're there and you're witnessing it as opposed to just listening to it, and I think that's a real gift.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, the book is so much more than just your story, as inspiring as that is, and it comes along at a time when so many people are feeling stressed and anxious and lost, and maybe more than anything else, it seems, disconnected.
What would you say to those individuals who are having their Uruguay moment, and that's where you bottomed out, that might help them take that first critical step?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think, look, a couple of things I wanted to do with the book. I wanted to show people that, you know, no matter how stuck you might feel, no matter how you might have messed up in the past, chances are you weren't half as bad as I was. I mean, it would be, unless you killed someone, as you read this, it's going to be hard to imagine a worse person that you might know. And I really wanted to show that nobody is beyond redemption, and it's never too late to change course, to walk 180 degrees in the other direction. And I did that by returning to a lost faith and a mm-hmm. lost virtue and a lost morality. And, you know, I would hope to say to people, look, your past doesn't need to define your future. And in fact, you know, all those terrible things in your past, all those mistakes, the things that you might be ashamed of, you can actually use to power a very different and significant future. And, you know, if a scumbag, cokehead, degenerate nightclub promoter can help bring clean drinking water to 8.5 million people and raise $250 million, you know, what might others do that haven't even, you know, sunk to the depths of despair that I had? And the wonderful thing, I think, too, about, you know, maybe this book at this moment is water is an unbelievable, it's a unifying issue.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're a Jew, whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Muslim, whether you're a Mormon or an atheist, you know, whether you're a Republican or an independent or a Democrat, everybody can come together and stand for clean water for others. Regardless of those beliefs, it's a big tent.
Yeah.
And it's been so exciting to see people who might fight to the death on every social or political issue known to man, but can come together under that tent and say, you know what? We believe in generosity. We believe in compassion. We believe that human beings need this basic, they need to have this basic need met to thrive. And we'll support this.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Let me close with this, Scott. Charity Water has helped to reimagine for the better what a nonprofit organization can and should be. The 100% model that you talked about a moment ago, your use of technology, radical transparency, and so on. The organization is now into its second decade. How do you see it being different, and what new boundaries do you think you're going to be pushing here in the next decade?
Well, it's been an exciting time of growth. We started the new decade growing 40% last year in America. International giving was actually down 6%.
Right.
We continued that growth this year. We're seeing 40% growth again this year. We're coming in to raise about $70 million this year.
Fantastic.
So I think, you know, when you put two 40% years back together, you start thinking bigger. So we just unveiled a plan to our shareholders, the 131 families, to pay for all the overhead at Charity Water, to pay for the OPEX and the staff. We unveiled a $1 billion plan where we want to get 25 million new people clean water by 2025. That's going to require us going about four times as fast, investing four times more in the field in a lot less time. So I think we're thinking about how do we take everything we've learned in 12 years and use that to propel a more sustainable, more impactful, more scalable future of Charity Water. We feel like the best is yet to come.
Yeah, and an audacious goal like that will get you think differently, that's for sure.
That's right. You can't incrementalize your way when you set such big targets. And that's exciting for us to think about what would need to be different in the next 6 or 7 years. You know, what got us here will not get us there.
Yeah, no, it is exciting. Well, Scott Harrison, the founder and CEO of Charity Water and the author of Thirst, A Story of Redemption, Compassion, and a Mission to Bring Clean Water to the World. Thanks so much for being here this evening. I urge everyone to pick up a copy. And if not for yourself, perhaps someone close to you that would benefit from a remarkable and inspiring story. It was a real pleasure to have you here, Scott.
Thanks, Edward. And just a reminder, you know, all the money goes to Charity Water, so I don't make a penny from the book. So just in doing that, they're actually supporting the need of people around the world with clean water.
Thanks for that word.
It's time for Take Five, a recurring feature of the business of giving with five or so quick questions posed to the leaders of the world of philanthropy, business, and social enterprise.
Mm-hmm. We're going to play Take 5 with Eric S. Goldstein, the Chief Executive Officer of UJA Federation New York. Are you ready to go?
I am.
What should we be worried about?
Hunger.
What is one of your favorite documentaries or movies?
Godfather.
What is today's most underreported story?
Exploding elderly.
What idea in philanthropy is ready for retirement?
Cold calling.
What is the most important thing that makes for a healthy organizational culture?
Passion in the mission of the organization.
If you were a kitchen utensil, what would you be?
A knife.
What do you wish people would be more open and honest about?
Their failures.
If you were to start your career all over again and do something completely different and away from this field and the legal field, what do you think that might be?
Photographer.
What is your superpower?
Empathy.
If you could have one gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, what would you have it say?
Time for good.
What is something, whether this is related to your work or not, that you are exceptionally excited about right now?
The potential of our young people.
What would you speak about if you were asked to give a TED Talk on something outside your main area of expertise?
Acknowledging failure.
What is something about you that very few other people know?
I cry at GE commercials.
Given the choice of anyone famous in the world, dead or alive, that you could invite over as a dinner guest, who would that be?
Have to be Moses.
What is the best constructive criticism you have ever received?
It's okay to delegate.
What advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
Follow your passion.
And finally, do you have a quote you live your life by or think of often?
I generally ask, what would my parents do?
Thanks, Eric. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Marta Tolato, the president and CEO of Consumers Reports. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.